Having your cat declawed is difficult for the cat and the owner. Today, we'll talk about some alternatives to the procedure. Hi, Jill Nadeau here. I'm filling in for Larry today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is back with us. She is a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And besides talking about alternatives to decline, we'll be talking about tapeworms. And of course, we'll be answering your pet care questions. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And of course, we always like to see pictures of your pets. Sandy, it's so good to see you.
Nice to be back, Jill.
On this rainy day.
Yeah, you know, but that's why I love having indoor cats, you know, because it gives me something warm. They like to cuddle. And I have two older cats at home as well as dogs.
Uh-huh.
And I thought this would be maybe a good time to talk about some of the things that are hitting the veterinary news regarding cats and their claws. And and I'm not going to say one way or the other, kind of which way I take a stand on things, because I like to just provide information and let owners and their veterinarian help make the decision. But it may be taken out of the hands of some owners, because there are some of the states on the East Coast that are trying to pass legislation to ban declawing unless there is a medical necessity for it, such as a serious nail bed infection or a tumor or something like that, not for behavioral causes. So there may be parts of the country where you won't be able to have that done. Mm-hmm. So yeah. But you know, when I live with cats with claws, and I think the big thing is understanding why cats scratch.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. What is the point?
Well, you know, obviously, number one, and I think why a lot of people end up having trouble with claws is they don't understand why they do it. And cats scratch for a number of reasons. One is leaving a visual cue behind that I live here, okay? So it's kind of like us putting up graffiti on a wall. Cats do it with the damaged furniture. And so that's why they often will scratch in kind of highly contested areas, like that corner of the couch where they're sitting and looking out at that cat that's outside that's bothering them. They'll go ahead and scratch and leave a mark behind. They're also leaving a scent mark behind because they have pheromones in their feet that will attract them back to those spots. Which is why you have to get cats comfortable with scratching on appropriate things very early on, so they'll continue to go back to those areas that have that visual cue and that scent cue. Obviously, they're honing their claws. Unlike dogs, where the nails continue to grow in length, cats' nails grow in depth. And so when they are having those shells built up on their claws by going up and scratching, or sometimes with their back feet, you'll actually see cats chewing on their toes to kind of take those shells off of them. So honing their claws, stretching their limbs. A lot of cats like to scratch when they first wake up. And so that's often, again, a spot if your cat sleeps on your bed and then jumps out of bed, does a big stretch, and then goes over to your headboard or whatever and scratches. That's because it's where they like to sleep. And then, of course, it's defensive. You know, they come into the vet clinic and get a little upset, or they're fighting with one of their housemates, and hunting as well, so they can capture their prey. So there's a lot of reasons, you know, both kind of behavioral from the standpoint of I'm stressed and I'm leaving my mark behind, to just physiologic that is normal for cats to be able to do that. And even cats that are declawed will continue to go up and rub their feet on things because they're leaving their scent behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then, taking declawing out of it, what are some of the things that we can do?
Number one is regular trimming. And cats are the easiest to trim. And I know people say, oh, I don't know how to do it. But have your veterinarian show you. Start young. And mm-hmm. I like to have them sit in my lap where their backbone is against my stomach and so on. And their little legs are sitting out. So I'm not pulling on their legs and their feet. And you can very quickly get the nails trimmed that way. And it's easy to do because you can see the blood supply in the quick, which is something that for dogs, we can run into troubles with when we're cutting nails. So number one, and make it fun. Have food involved. I bring out little jars of baby food or canned cat food, and the cat's got a spoonful of something while somebody else is doing some trimming. And so we make it fun. Number two, provide scratching posts. They need to be tall enough that when the cat's standing on their back legs, it reaches their total length. So if you've got a big Maine Coon, you've got a tall scratching post. So also has to be sturdy. I go into pet stores and I look at some of these scratching posts and I'm thinking, why would anybody buy that? Something that swings from a doorknob or that's really short, that's got a dog or a bed on top of it where the cat has to be down on their side to scratch, needs to be really tall and sturdy, preferably with sisal rope. That seems to be the thing that most cats like the best, although some cats do like cardboard. Some do like, instead of horizontal or vertical, I should say, scratching posts, they do like some of those horizontal things that are you can put on your floor that, again, are sturdy, sometimes made out of cardboard and very inexpensive. So you have to know what your cat likes, and it may mean experimenting, using a couple of different things and trying to find out what your cat likes. I also like to make sure that scratching posts are positioned in the right places. Remember earlier on, I said those hotly contested areas like that front window where they may be seeing a stray cat. That's where the scratching post needs to be. Obviously, it's probably right where your prized piece of furniture is as well. So it may mean that you have to move or cover up your furniture and put the scratching post there. If you have a cat, you have to decorate for your cat. So that means living with the scratching post, maybe in your living room, maybe in your bedroom, if that's where your cat likes to sleep. And you may need multiple scratching posts to all those areas where the cat may want to scratch during the day. Don't encourage rough play with claws. I see people do this all the time where they pull their sleeve over their hand and they wrestle with the cat, and the cat starts learning to grab with their claws and scratch, and it becomes kind of normal play for the cat because we encourage it. And instead, use toys on strings and wands. Just, again, so you're not encouraging the cat to scratch you or use their claws in play. And it also comes down to addressing conflict. If you've got multiple cats in the household and they're not getting along and they're scratching to mark their territory, maybe look at adding in extra litter boxes, extra sleeping areas, more feeding stations. So again, it's just a more harmonious household so that the cat may not want to mark their territory as much. But there's something else, okay, that we like to do.
Light on the horizon.
Yeah. You know, people have always, I've heard of soft paws, the little plastic nail caps that you can glue on. Obviously, you have to trim claws before you can put those on. So I didn't bring that up earlier, but those are also available. They stay on for a variable period of time because cats' nails shed.
Sure.
It's husk, and they may fall off the day after you put them on. They may stay on for a couple of months. But the new product that's out on the market that's just hit the United States is made by a company named Seva, and it's called Feely Scratch, F-E-L-I, Scratch, all one word. And it comes in a little bag, and you get 8 little pipettes of this solution that mimics the pheromone that's in their feet. And so this is something that you put on the area that you want your cat to scratch.
Oh.
So imagine you bring a new cat in, and you've got that brand new scratching post that doesn't have anything frayed, doesn't have any scent on it. You put it in that prize corner in your living room, and you start every day putting some of these this liquid on. It has a blue tint to it, and so the cat will actually see vertical marks. So it has that look of being, hey, something scratched here, but it also has the scent. And they've shown that cats, like 80% plus of cats where we use this, will very quickly, within a week, direct their scratching to the scratching post and leave your furniture alone.
80%.
Mm-hmm. Runs about $25 to $30. So when you start weighing it out, you know, hey, and it may be just a one-time deal where you have to do it. You do it for the first week and then a couple of more times after that. And that may be the only thing you have to do for the rest of the cat's life.
Now, what if you already have an adult cat? Do you think something like that would help?
Yes, they've actually shown that for adult cats, it even works. Now, you'd probably need to go back to the basics, the right size scratching post in the right location, covering up or removing your furniture that the cat's already left their scent on and their scratch marks so that they're not attracted back to that. So you may have to put some plastic over it or something. They even make a double-sided sticky tape that's called sticky paws, that it doesn't hurt your furniture, but when the cat puts their feet up on it, they don't like the feel of it because their fur sticks. And that would be something to prohibit the cat from scratching at it. But you always have to get back to, what can I do to get the cat to scratch on the thing that I want it to scratch at?
Well, great.
Yeah. So I hope that's good advice for people. And that might help those people that are in other states that may not have declawing as
an
option.
Sure. Yeah. And where can you get that? get it for you?
You can get it through veterinarians. I went online and just saw that it's available through a couple of online pet supply places now. Runs $25 to $30.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And again, that's Feli Scratch.
Scratch. Right.
F-E-L-I Scratch. Okay, great. Because yeah. People are going to call. So, and speaking of calling, let's go right over to our phones. We've had Carol on the line. I'm sorry, Joe in La Crosse. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
What's your question?
I've got a couple two-part question here. I'm wondering just what is so bad about it, the declawing cats, why a person couldn't get their cat to a vet, numb them up good with some lidocaine type of medicine, and even leave them in there for a few days, and, you know, all the songbirds they kill.
Yeah,
because nobody really keeps them on leashes. And
yeah. Well, that's some really good talking points here. Number one, declawed cats still hunt and are still able to hunt because they use their teeth and they adapt. And we find that there was one study done a while ago that showed that about 60% of declawed cats, even though they're supposed to remain indoors, become indoor-outdoor cats. And so they've lost their own defense with maybe able to climb trees, but they are still able to hunt and kill birds. So it's not going to stop predation. So that's something that is, kind of a misconception out there. Declawing is a surgical procedure. If you held your hand up and looked at your hand right now and you removed the bone from your last joint down, okay, so that where the nail is attached, you have to get the entire bone as well as all the nail-producing tissue off. It is a painful surgery. It does require cats to be on post-operative pain medication. Some cats will have permanent discomfort, even though you may see limping and things afterwards. It has been associated with cats to having more issues with biting. When they've lost their ability to use their claws, they may use their teeth more. So there may be some behavioral besides the medical implications with having it done. So it's not like us just, trimming our nails. It is an amputation. And it's like the third phalanx on all the feet are removed. And I've seen some pretty bad horror stories over the years. I've seen many successful declaws. By far, many, many more successful ones, but that odd one that comes back to haunt you can be something that you live with for the rest of your life professionally. So there's a couple of places I'd like people to go to get more information on declawing, because I think you need to look at it from kind of both sides. One is there's a website called The Paw Project, all one word, www.pawproject.com. And this is by a group of veterinarians that present a lot of data on declawing and talk about many of the things that I just spoke about. And they are on the side of kind of, no, don't declaw your cat. And then, you can also, be looking at other veterinary sites, like surgical sites and so on, that will give you how the surgery is done and how it can be done properly. Many veterinarians are now doing laser surgery, which helps coagulate the blood. It's a little less painful. They get up and get walking more quickly after surgery. It obviously is more expensive, but that would be something, again, if you're contemplating declawing, talk to your veterinarian about all the options, all the different methods that can be done before you make that decision.
Thank you very much for the question, and thank you for that great answer, Dr. Sandy. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. We're talking to Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Do you have a pet care question? Well, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, and you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Tomorrow at this time, join us for our annual, I'm not sure, twice a year wildlife roundtable. Our three wildlife writers will discuss the fall deer hunt, rules and regulations, and some of the changes that's been going on with the DNR. I hope you can join us for that on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking to Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, and she's taking your pet care questions. And let's go right back to the phones, Sandy. Carol in Rice Lake, you're up next.
Yes, we adopted a dog who was in a group of dogs that came from a puppy mill in South Texas. In March 23, she tested negative for heartworm. But in June, before her spay, she tested positive for heartworm. She gets her first molarsamine shot on Friday. What, if any, tests should be done before that shot?
Oh, you know, this is one of my, I'm kind of a pet peeve of you know, rescue groups that are bringing animals up from down south is they, where heartworm is very endemic. We have it here in Wisconsin. It's not at the same level as it is in other parts of the country. There's a website, the it's called Companion Animal Parasite Council. They actually have parasite maps on there, so that if you're moving to a new area or adopting a pet from an area, you can kind of see what the incidence of these diseases are before that animal is, you know, brought into your home. So you kind of know what to be looking out for. The reason why your dog tested negative in the spring and then later on, a couple of months later, positive, is that the incubation period for heartworm to develop to a point where we can detect it on a blood test is about 6 or 7 months. So my guess is that the dog was probably exposed sometime last winter or maybe late in the fall, was tested before it was adopted, was tested negative because the female worms had not matured to the point where you could detect them, because we're actually looking for proteins from the uterus of the female worm. So if the female is immature, they're going to test negative, but you let your vet did the perfect thing, retest again a few months later, and unfortunately your dog was positive. What we typically do for treating dogs with heartworm, it's a little complicated, which is why I always recommend keep your dog on heartworm preventative year-round, because the treatment isn't very much fun. We keep them on heartworm preventative for a couple of months, and we also treat them with an antibiotic called doxycycline, because there's another bug that likes to live inside heartworm called Wolbachia. And I know, it's like these two bugs living together. You've got one that's the worm and one that's living inside the worm. And what we want to do is kill that Wolbachia before we start killing the worms, because if you just go ahead and treat the heartworm, then the Wolbachia gets released and it triggers a much more serious reaction in the lungs as those worms die off. So a couple of months of pre-treatment, your dog then gets an injection of molarsamine. And usually we like to get some chest x-rays to see kind of pre-treatment, what the chest looks like. If you can have your veterinarian do an echocardiogram, especially to rule out things like pulmonary hypertension, which is a complication of heartworm that may need long-term treatment afterwards, that's also very helpful. But not every veterinarian is capable or has the equipment. I should say they're capable, but they may not have the equipment to be able to do that. The drug that's given is an injectable drug. It's painful. It goes in the muscle. Your dog will then need to be sedated or kenneled and kept very quiet for the next month. Then they go through two more injections 24 hours apart and another month of being either sedated or kenneled, so that as those worms die off, they're not showering into the lungs. So it's a long, drawn-out process, several months of treatment, and then the last 2 months are not very much fun for anybody because of the way the dog has to be handled. They have to go outside and go potty on a leash. They can't be excited. They can't run to the door when the doorbell rings, because that could be enough to cause thromboembolism of those dead worms and could be life-threatening for your dog. So good luck. I hope everything goes okay. And congratulations on getting your new dog. But it's just one of those risks with dogs coming from the South.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks for calling in on that, Carol. Let's go to Ann in Madison next. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I have a male cat who is about 11 or 12. Nobody knows the history beyond about 5 years ago. He, rather than twitch his tail a whole lot, he does once in a while, but he very regularly just casually swishes his tail fully.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's evidence that he gets along with dogs, so I think maybe he had early access and use with dogs. Could you tell me how much of tail behavior is innate and how much is behavioral.
I'm smiling here because I, you know, this it is. I really doubt that your cat learned to wag its tail because of being raised around dogs. The tail is one of those things that, as veterinarians, we're always watching when we're doing our exam because that's kind of our displeasure meter, okay?
Right.
And
right.
So when a cat is just comfortable and relaxed, the tail will be in a relaxed position, and, you know, just kind of sitting there not doing anything. If you look at young kittens, they'll often do what we call the anal presentation, where their tail is straight up in the air, the hair isn't bushy on the tail, and it's you know, they are, that's just a kind of normal kitten behavior. Then we can get the cat that's really fearful, and you get that Halloween-like cat where the tail is up and really puffed out. Or the cat that is really assertive, you may see that tail be puffed out and just pulled straight down. But that flicking is just saying, I am alert and wary of whatever's going on in the environment. It is not an indication that the cat is happy, relaxed, or anything like that. Unlike dogs, and even people misinterpret dog tail wagging as well as, you know, dogs wagging its tail, it must be friendly. It just means that, you know, the dog is alert and paying attention to things in the environment. You have to look at the entire body, the eyes, the mouth, the ears, and so on, the rest of the body posture. So it sounds like your cat's just a pretty low-key, relaxed cat that every once in a while becomes alert to something and wags its tail a little bit.
Okay, great question, Ann. Thank you very much. Lillian in Green Bay, you're up next.
Good morning. Nice to talk with you. I have a cat who is 6 years old. He is not declawed, but he does let me trim his toenails. But he has a habit of scratching on the carpet all over the house.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking it's to get my attention because when he does it, I yell at him.
Yeah, and that is a possibility. Yeah, yeah.
He does have 3 scratching posts in different places in the house. He uses them occasionally. But he just seems to be more happy scratching on the carpet.
What I would be recommending is you start looking at some of the horizontal scratching devices that are available for cats, like the compressed cardboard that is, you know, again, very inexpensive. There are some that are, they call it the Alpine cat, which is more kind of maybe about 45 degrees of an angle. There's a number of things like that, and put that in the area where your cat is scratching on the carpet. And just like I mentioned earlier in the show about covering up the areas where the cat scratches with plastic, tin foil, double-sided sticky tape, something to detract your cat from that area, but providing them with something that has the texture that your cat likes. And this would be a perfect case for using something like that Feel-A-Scratch. I think that that you could put that on the new scratching things, and that may attract the cat to that area, especially if the other areas are not made as nice for the cat, like with the double-sided sticky tape.
Okay, well, great. Thank you, Lillian. I've used that sticky tape before, and it has worked.
It does. And it does come in big sheets, mm-hmm. and it'll even come on, like, for cats that like to get into houseplants and dig. Mm-hmm. I've had people, you know, stick it down onto, like, sticks that they can crisscross over their potted plants, so the plant can still get water, the soil can breathe, but the cat gets in there, and these things stick to them, and, yeah. So
yuck.
There's lots of different uses, yeah.
Gotta outsmart those cats. Okay, well, let's go on to Steve in La Crosse. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a question. I have a terrier, and we acquired it from my mother who passed away, and the dog's about 8. It's kind of, it's gotten diabetes, so we're having to give it shots twice a day, in the morning and the evening. I'm just wondering if there's anything that might help this out. Is there anything out there new that's cutting down on the shots? She's very sensitive. Is the best place, you know, behind the neck?
Mm-hmm.
She seems to be losing weight, so she's getting keen to the fact that she's going to get a shot. And,
yeah.
And, she's very sensitive to it. I'm not a vet, so I'm not going to give it
right.
a shot. So
right.
we're running here. But and the dog also goes to the bathroom in the house a ton because my mom was older, and she would just leave the door open into the garage at our house. Well, now the dog's not, so it's going in our house a lot.
Oh.
And I know, you know, we're really struggling with this.
Well, it's I totally understand what you're going through because I have several clients that have diabetic dogs. I have never personally lived with a diabetic dog, but they are a full-time commitment. And the fact that the dog is urinating in the house and losing weight tells me that it's probably not well regulated. And these are patients that you become really good friends with your veterinarian. And typically what needs to be done is finding out if you're using the right amount of insulin. And checking urine is very unreliable, so we have to do little blood tests. And there are at-home glucose monitors, and we teach owners how to get a drop of blood from like ear margin veins and different places that may not be that uncomfortable for the pet, so that sometimes they can be monitored at home. Other times they need to go into the hospital and have what we call a glucose curve done, where they're fed their normal diet, they're given their insulin, and then every 2 hours for about 12 hours, we see what their blood sugar is doing so we can start adjusting and maybe changing to a different type of insulin if necessary to be able to help the dog. It's really important that they're on a strict diet as well, that they're not getting a lot of snacks during the day. That can throw off regulation. Typically, we have them on a high fiber diet. That seems to help slow the glucose absorption through the gut. And so these are diets that are usually ones that you're going to be getting as a therapeutic diet from a veterinarian, not something over the counter. So that's going to be another thing that you may want to talk to your veterinarian about, getting that looked into. The other reason why we see dogs becoming unregulated is if they have some other underlying diseases, even things, simple things like dental disease, which a dog that's 8 years of age, that could be enough to throw off their diabetes management. I just dealt with a little pug that became diabetic. Unfortunately, after eating a pork chop, she developed pancreatitis, and that inflamed pancreas killed the cells that make insulin, and she became a insulin-dependent diabetic, which almost all dogs are. I don't know of any dog patients that can go on like the glipizide and things like that. I don't know what is it called for people, the oral hypoglycemics. I can't remember what they're called, but cats, sometimes we can get by with that, but usually in dogs, we're looking at needing insulin. And she became unregulated, and it turned out that she became hypothyroid at the same time, and that caused some problems with managing her diabetes. So that's why, I mean, you're going to be probably every month or two going in for some blood work, your analysis, different things to be able to get your dog through this.
Okay. Well, thank you for that call, Steve. And I know that's the difficultest to
is.
To deal
it's
with.
Expensive, mm-hmm. and it is, like I said, very time, the commitment that people have to make to be on a schedule to feed your dog at the same time and be mm-hmm. always there to be able to help them.
Right, yep. And kudos for taking care of your mom's puppy. Let's go to, we had a question from Krista on Facebook, and she wanted to know if you could discuss safe toys for larger dogs that like to chew. She heard that cow ears or cow bones are bad for their teeth.
Yeah.
What are some alternatives?
Well, our dental staff at the vet school say that anything that you hit yourself with that's hard enough to hurt you, if you hit yourself in the shin with it and it hurts, shouldn't go in a dog's mouth because it can break teeth.
Oh, interesting.
And so they don't like to see things like, you know, bone, like regular beef bones or hard things like the hard Nyla bones being used. And so it becomes a little bit of a shopping dilemma for that really heavy duty chewer. Number one, I would try to have them develop some other interests in life besides chewing. You know, getting them into doggy daycare, getting them out for walks and more exercise, because that tired dog's going to be a well-behaved dog. And so look at it from that standpoint, that if chewing is the only thing the dog has in life, what else can we do to make them have other things that they can do. Then we start looking at what can we buy over the counter that is that works. And I've got kind of a small list of things to try, but any toy, you always want to make sure that you are watching and making sure that your dog is not one of those exceptions that's able to destroy it quickly. One that I like is one that's called Go Nuts. It's spelled G-O-U-G-H, nuts, like donuts, but Go Nuts. Dogs go nuts for Go Nuts, okay? They actually have a colored core in the middle, and so they're either black or green, and they have a red core, and when you get down to that red showing, that's the time to throw the thing out because it's going to start becoming dangerous where pieces may start breaking off. Kong Company makes some toys that are called Kong Extreme, not just the standard stuffable toy, but some other shapes and sizes that your dog may like as well. The Outward Hound Company makes these fire hose toys that are... I've had dogs even chew those up, but I think it's always worth a try. Some dogs are able to handle them. They don't have stuffing in them, but they're really sturdy. And there's another thing that I actually have for my dogs. It's called the tire biters, and they look like tires, but they're made out of heavy-duty rubber, and they have yet to destroy that. So there are some things out there that work, but I've had every one of those toys. I've had people say my dog destroys them. So just always be on the lookout and try to find other interests for your dog.
I had a dog who destroyed a can of tuna.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They can bite through those things.
Oh, so squished it flat.
Yeah.
Amazing. On my couch. We won't go there. Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Liz in Fond du Lac, what's your question?
Hi. I'm driving, so I hope we keep our reception. We'll be driving cross-country with two cats. Our two cats who are already traumatized just going to the vet. So I have sedatives for them. I haven't tried them on a dress rehearsal yet. I'm thinking I'm just going to have their cat beds and their cat carriers in the back section of the car so that they can either hide or have a little bit of roaming space while we're on the road for hours each day.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be stopping at motels along the way, wherever we find them. So are there any other
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
I can just imagine, you know, the yowling cat as you're crossing the country, you know, if they're not used to being in the car. And you can start now with very short trips. Unfortunately, for many cats, the only time they ever go in the car is to go to the veterinary clinic. And so they may associate car rides with things that aren't that much fun. So maybe start doing things like putting your cat in the carrier. Look at getting bigger carriers. I don't think it's safe to have your cat loose in the car. I've had cats get up under the dashboard, under your feet while you're driving. I had one owner that actually stopped at a rest stop and very quickly opened the door to get out, and their cat took off and they never found it. And they were in another state. So make sure that your cat's confined in a carrier. It may mean getting a larger, like dog size carrier where you can put a cat bed and a small litter box. It doesn't have to be anything bigger than a shoebox, but something, a small litter box in the carrier. And, you know, using a real low-dust cat litter so that they're not in a dusty environment would be helpful. You may want to also be looking at using medications. And you've already said you've got some sedatives. There's, some cats, I always do a test drive before you use something like this, because I've had some cats where you give them a sedative. Usually veterinarians prescribe a drug called acepromazine. I've had some cats become very vocal on that, where it doesn't stop them from being vocal. It may slow them down a little bit, but they're still crying and making a lot of noise. You could also ask your veterinarian about trying gabapentin. It's a drug that we use for neuropathic pain in people and in animals, but it also has some good sedative properties, and we've been using that frequently for cats that don't like coming into the vet clinic. We give it a couple hours before their appointment, and we can get x-rays done and procedures on cats that we normally couldn't even touch. And so they still are alert, and they're not so sedated that they're just going to sleep the whole time. Make sure you have forms of IDs on your cat. Get them microchipped. Have your address where you're going to on a tag on the outside so that they can find you. If you have your old address, they may not be able to find you. So if you do have an escapee, at least you have a chance of being reconnected at some point. And if you're stopping in hotels, beware. They often rent out the same rooms for, you know, that are the pet rooms. And I've had people become very disappointed because their pets have picked up fleas because the last the customers that were there left them behind. So make sure that your pet is on flea control if you're going to be staying in hotels. And bring food and water from home. Even things like the taste of water in a different state could be enough to have your cat not want to drink and become dehydrated. So, you know, try to make it as stress-free as you can by bringing all those comforts from home.
Stress-free for everybody.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Liz. Have fun with that. Up next, we have Lori in Oconomowoc. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Dr. Sandy. I would like to ask you, my concern is I have a neighbor who is in jail. She's been there for 1 month, and to my understanding, could be there for another 7 or 8 months. She has a cat that is currently living alone in her apartment. There is somebody that is popping in once a day during the week to feed it and change its box, give it clean water. But my concern is the psychosocial, emotional aspect for the cat.
Yeah, yeah. And that, I mean, it really depends on the cat. Some cats are very comfortable. They can be more aloof. They don't really care whether there's a human there or not, just as long as they're provided for. You may want to look into having lots of toys and things to keep the cat mentally stimulated, either things that are on the ground that may be battery operated. There's even some cool online devices that there's one that's called the Pet Cube, where from your cell phone, you can make a laser pointer go. So you can be in another part of the city and you can, you know, call up that cube and make a laser pointer go around, and you can actually watch the cat as well. And that may be something that, while the owner's in jail, they're not that expensive. They could have something like that, and I don't know if they're allowed to be able to, you know, make phone calls or whatever, or be able to go online and do things like that, but that would be something that it would at least keep the cat entertained. One other thing to just be thinking about, and I'm not sure where you are in the state, but in the Madison area, we have associated with the veterinary school a group that's called WhiskCares, and we offer boarding and fostering for people that are in situations like this, where something is temporary and we can see an end to it. Where it may just be you're homeless for a couple of weeks and you need to, you know, have a place for your cat or dog to be boarded. Or, you know, it may be for something a little bit longer where the cat may have can go to someone else's home. If the cat is not that social, that may not work out. They may be very happy being where they are. So I'd have to kind of evaluate on a case-by-case basis as to say what would be best. But I think I'm glad someone's taking care of this cat and checking every day. That would have me worried if they weren't being evaluated daily.
Right. And thank you, Lori, for calling in, because I know it sounds like you're concerned about the kitty, too. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show, and I'm Jill Nadeau sitting in for Larry today. We're talking with Dr. Sandy Sachuk. Do you have a pet care question? Our lines are full right now, but you can always send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, we're talking about pet care with our regular Dr. Sandy Sachuk today. And Sandy, before we go back to the phones, we want to talk a little bit about tapeworm. I know it's almost lunchtime.
Yeah.
But I mean, is this something that affects a lot of our pets?
It sure does. And you know, the issue is that it kind of surprises people, because often pets have no symptoms of having this as a parasite. I think it's a kind of an old wives' tale that, you know, if they have tapeworms, they're going to be losing weight and not doing well. Most pets are going to live with them quite well. Tapeworms are unique in that they are not contagious pet to pet. So the reason why I'm bringing this up is I had an owner very concerned because she saw her year-old dog. She's picking up stool, and she saw tapeworm segments. They're little pieces of moving worm on the surface of the dog's stool. And this dog goes to doggy daycare, and it hangs with her mother's elderly dog, and she has a cat in the house. And she was like, do I have to treat everybody? And what's, you know, what's going on? And tapeworms, what you're seeing is just a piece of it. They are a very long worm that reproduce by passing these little egg packets that come out on the surface of the stool passively. And you may see them dried in the hair around the rectum. You may see them in the dog bed as well, because they make crawl out on their own, and they'll often dry and look like a little piece of almost like dried rice, or can be even as small as a sesame seed. The tapeworms that we have here in our area, pets get them two ways. One is by ingesting a flea. And you're thinking, how is that tapeworm inside a flea? Because the flea is tiny. Well, the flea contains the cyst stage of the tapeworm. So somewhere in the flea life cycle, probably when it was a little larva, it ingested a tapeworm egg. And it just becomes, it just kind of sits in the body of the flea. And then as the pet chews the flea off itself, it'll hatch out into the dog or cat's intestinal tract. And then weeks or months later, you'll see little segments being passed in the stool. The other way, which in our area, because we don't see a whole lot of flea cases, is from eating rodents or other prey. And that is how Snooky, the dog that had tapeworms, ended up getting them. He's quite the avid hunter. And so he probably ate a dead bunny or caught a mouse and ate it. And the mouse has the cyst stage in it. And so the only way the other pets that this animal could be get tapeworms from Snooky would be to have, if Snooky caught the prey and they shared in a meal together. And that wasn't happening at daycare, and it wasn't happening with the indoor cat. And so really it was just Snooky needed to be treated. And one of the recommendations that I make for people that have dogs, especially that are chronic hunters that like to eat and you just never know when they're going to start passing tapeworms, is there are heartworm preventatives on the market now, and we're using heartworm preventative year round, and there's several brands now that have the tapeworm medication in it, and it's very inexpensive. And it's, you know, it doesn't add much cost more than regular heartworm preventative. And you just give it once a month and it takes care of deworming the dog. And I think it really works out well. For cats, different story. There aren't any heartworm preventatives that have the active ingredient praziquantel in it, but there are some topical treatments now. So you don't have to pill your cat, which can sometimes be hard because that particular drug tastes really evil. And so there's one. It's called Profender that the Bayer Company makes. It just goes on their skin, on the back of their neck, and you can have your pet taken care of. You can get this medication over the counter, too.
Really?
It is. You do not need a prescription for it, but not all dewormers are created equal. If you think your pet has tapeworms, you have to make sure you use something that has this active ingredient called praziquantel in it. If you go to your local pet store or farm store, you're going to find lots of other dewormers that are available over the counter that are not going to get tapeworms. So that's where sometimes it's just so much easier. Just go to your vet. They'll give you the right size, something easy to apply, like the topical stuff, or the heartworm preventative, which is a prescription product, and that makes it easy as well.
Okay, and what are the dangers to the pet if they have a tapeworm?
Really nothing.
Okay.
I've had some make a U-turn down an anal gland duct and have an impacted anal gland. It can sometimes cause them to be really itchy. They may be a little unthrifty with them because if they're really loaded, it could be a problem, but it's more the gross out factor for the human.
Yeah.
I had an owner come in and with a little Ziploc bag and said, why am I finding sesame seeds on my pillow? And when I told her they were tapeworm segments, she almost fainted.
Oh,
and, you know,
my
because
gosh.
Her cat slept on her pillow
sure,
with her and
sure.
was passing tapeworm segments.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, now we can prevent that.
Yes.
So that's a good thing.
Right.
Thank you. All right. Well, let's go back. Next up, we have Judy from Eau Claire. Hi, Judy. What's your question today? Judy, are you with us? Judy,
huh?
Oh, I think we're going to have to...
Hello?
Oh, Judy, there you are. Okay, I was afraid we were going to have to go off. What's your question?
Oh, my question is, I have a wonderful 3-year-old black lab who enjoys barking.
What a surprise.
Right.
And she loves to be outside, but if anybody walks by, and we do have quite a few walkers, or cars, or trucks, or whatever, she starts barking, and I immediately call her, and she'll come right away. But I feel like I'm on bark control all day.
Mm-hmm,
you know, it just doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
But my vet suggested a bark collar, and I just didn't feel good about that. And then another trainer suggested a collar that lets off a little smell
mm-hmm.
when they bark, and I didn't know if that was a gimmick or not. I have tried to train her not to bark, but that doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, I've talked to her about no barking.
Yeah.
And I look her in the eye.
Yeah. You know, you can try when they are kind of in a bark mode to say no bark, and when they stop to take that piece of, you know, good treat out of your hand, then they know, oh, silence gets the reward. But I think sometimes, you know, getting down to the reason why dogs are barking, and obviously in your dog's case, it's an alarm barking. She can see things going by, and instead of saying, hey, there's a walker going by, I'm going to sit on my fanny and just watch, which you can train her to do, but it does mean you've got to be, you know, right on top of her and outside 100% of the time with her so that you can redirect her behavior to something more appropriate than barking. And I think we also get into trouble as people is we yell at the dog. And so a jogger's going by, a car's going by, the dog barks, we bark, the dog thinks, oh, this is great. This is a big bark fest. I'm going to just, you know, this is something really we need to be concerned about because look, even mom's barking now. So using a bark collar, the one that I think is probably the most humane is the Citronella bark collar that you can get online. It's a collar that has a sensor in it that when the dog barks, it releases a stream of citronella that the dog sees, hears, and smells. And although we like that, you know, lemon pledge type smell, dogs find it aversive. I have had some dogs that will bark right through it and empty the collar out. It's failed in dogs that have a big fur ruff like your collie or sheltie, where it just kind of goes poof and sits in their hair and doesn't bother them. But for a Labrador Retriever, that may be something that would be effective. And I found them to be, looking at the in the literature, about 80% effective. So it might be worthwhile trying. But again, even with using that, you've got to provide your dog with, okay, you don't want her to bark. What do you want her to do? So instead of just saying no, what's the yes? And the yes is going to be, there's a jogger going by, run to the door, sit on your fanny, and that's a way to alert mom. And so that the collar will help you with being able to get the barking under control. The dog may let out a little one bark and then, oh, I don't like to bark like that because I get this spray of citronella. The other collars that are out there are shock collars. And I think ethically, I get a little concerned about that. There are some that will give the dog a warning cue, like a little sound or a tone before they get a shock. So that if you are going to go down that route, I would make sure that you get one that at least gives that dog the chance to be quiet and learn, oh, I hear that sound. That means I need to be quiet or something bad's going to happen. I think the Citronella collars are more humane. So that would be what I would recommend going for.
And they'll keep mosquitoes away. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Judy. Appreciate that. Joan in Viroqua, you're up next.
Hello. I have a 2-year-old black long-haired female cat, and she's always grooming herself, and she's developed some scabs under her neck, on her neck, under her chin, from scratching. Is this normal behavior for a long-haired cat?
No, it isn't. And I'd be taking your kitty into your veterinarian and having them evaluated. It could be something, typically when we've got itching, facial itching, scabs around the neck area, under the chin, that's classic for cats that have some type of an allergic dermatitis. And that would be something that your veterinarian could help you evaluate. It may come down to treating secondary infections first, because sometimes if they've traumatized themselves, they have a skin infection and that's adding to the itch. It may mean looking for some type of external parasite that can make them itchy. There are several that cats can get that you may not see with your naked eye, but you know, things like fleas, even then, cats get fleas, even indoor cats can get fleas. And they groom the fleas off, so you may not see them. And so we usually put them on flea control. And then, you know, looking into using other drugs to help with the itching, whether it's a short-term round of steroids or something that we can use more long-term, like cyclosporine, special diets. It's kind of a process that you go through to be able to get this thing worked up. There's a wonderful website called veterinarypartners.com, and that would be one that I would recommend going to. If you just put in, you know, cat allergies or allergic dermatitis in cats in the little search thing, you'll get lots of good client information. That's where I send all my clients to get. If you just need like a random information, that's probably the most reliable, written by veterinarians and always looked at and approved before being published by other vets as well.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for the call, Joan. Sandy, we've got about a minute left, but Mike, I think it was Mike here. Mike emailed to say he's always enjoyed your visits with the show. So do we, Mike. And you mentioned your dogs before. How many and what kinds of pets are currently in your home?
Okay. Well, I have three dogs. Bruce is almost 12-year-old, retired show dog, bulldog, who we got when he was 7, and he developed testicular cancer. Oh. Couldn't be shown, used for breeding. I gave him a retirement home. Oh. And then I have Pete, and he's another English bulldog. And Stanley, who's a who knows what. He came through Chicago English Bulldog Rescue. So those are the three dogs that I have, Pete, Bruce, and Stanley. And then I have two domestic cats, one that I bought an airline ticket for when she was in California, brought her home, and then another elderly kitty named Ollie. So,
oh,
yeah.
Well, lots of saving there. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. We've been talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She is a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Do you have a question on the health of your pet? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back after the news. So stay with us. Talking about pet care today on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel, and I'm filling in for Larry. His voice is not quite up to par today. And our guest is Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She's a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our phones are actually filled right now, so Sandy, let's just go right to the phones.
That sounds like
okay?
A good idea.
All right. Mark from Augusta, what's your question?
Well, I know that a lot of people are talking about fake news now. And I would like to talk about the first time I heard about milk bones. Mm-hmm. I was just a kid, and the Today Show had come out. Mm-hmm. And women were watching the Today Show around breakfast. And, you know, the kind of news that wouldn't normally make on the airwaves was that a dog had died from eating chicken bones somewhere in Maine. And everybody was saying, geez, you know, dogs love chicken bones. I've never heard of that before. And, you know, if you're a dog lover, of course, you kind of wonder. And then I remember I was only about 6 years old, and I thought, maybe it's just a coincidence that 2 days after this dogs dying of a chicken bone in Maine makes national news, that suddenly they announce that they've invented this milk bone, which is going to
The biscuit for dogs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, bones, animal bones in general, even if they're big enough that the dog, they're not going to splinter. They can break teeth, but many bones do splinter, and we can see intestinal perforations and, you know, obstructions and so on. So you've got to be really careful with it. And even though milk bone has bone in it and it's shaped like a bone, dogs don't care what they're shaped like. Those were manufactured and to look like something that looks like a bone so that we would give our dog a nice treat, which is, and many of the treats that are out there have like red dye in them and things to make them look more appetizing to us because it makes them look meaty. And remember, treats are just that, treats. There are some treats that can be a whole diet, and then you would see that there's an AFCO or American Association of Feed Control officials statement on the box or bag of treats that says that this will meet, you know, the dog's nutritional needs. But most of them are meant for just supplemental feeding. And, you know, Milk-Bones got, they were like the first kid on the block for dog treats for dogs. And since then, that whole business has exploded. But Milk-Bones themselves, as a way of keeping teeth clean, is, boy, they have to eat like 40 of them a day or something. Oh. That's ridiculous. There was a paper that was done where they looked at how many they would have to eat a day to be able to control tartar on dogs' teeth. And I don't remember what the number was, but all I remember is that that's like the dog's total caloric needs and then some. So remember, treats are just treats, and they're meant for dogs that are normal weight and for rewarding good behavior.
Okay. Let's go to Brianne in the Sullivan. Hi, Brianne.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. What I'm calling about is I have some 5-month-old kittens. There's 3 of them, but they're barn cats. So they live outside. We take really good care of them. They're all up to date on their shots and everything. But one male and one female. The male's name is George. Female's name is Hey Hey. The George will nurse on Hey Hey, and Hey Hey will nurse on herself.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Yeah.
And there's no like wounds or anything. That's not like it's gone, gotten to the point where it's like chafed and gotten raw or anything like that. But it's really weird. And I don't know if I should be concerned about this, if I should be.
Yeah, it's, you know,
vinegar on her. Or
what can she do, Sandy?
Well, if cats are weaned too early, sometimes we will start seeing some of this non-nutritional sucking, and it may be on things like blankets. It may be on the owner's earlobe. It may be on, you know, which I've seen happen on, you know, their litter mates. And typically, it's not going to cause any trouble, and it may be something that they will outgrow over time. We even see this in dogs. In fact, my own dog, Pete, who's going to be 4 in a few months, has 2 toys that have big noses on them. And when he is just wanting, he has this very ritualized behavior of grabbing one of these toys and laying, puts the nose in his mouth and sucks on it. And we can hear him from across the room nursing on his toys. And he stayed with his mother long enough that it shouldn't have been an issue. But it's just one of those behaviors that he's developed that isn't hurting anything because it's on, you know, items that I don't care about. But some of this, these cats that do this non-nutritional sucking behavior can become quite destructive. And we'll actually see them, you know, sometimes chewing holes in blankets and things. And they may ingest some of those things. And it can be annoying, too, to have this cat nursing next to you, you know, while you're trying to sleep at night. If they're both tolerating it, they're not hurting each other, I would just give it some time. And hopefully as they grow up, that'll be something that they'll find other interests and they'll stop doing it.
Okay. You know, speaking of cats, we've got a cat as our breed of the month. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, and I thought I would talk about a breed that's called the Manx cat. And people know about this breed because it's one of the few cats that is known as the tailless cat. It's a breed that doesn't breed true. What do I mean by that? It's a breed of cat that if you put, depending on how they're bred, the kittens may die very early on. It's a lethal gene. Okay. So it's a genetic issue that produces cats that have various lengths of tails. And what happened was back years and years ago on the Isle of Man, which is how they got their name, Manx, okay, from the Isle of Man, a cat was introduced that had the genetic defect for having this shorter or missing tail. And because it's on an island and the genetics was smaller, they were able to breed more of these cats, and it became, the island became known for all these tailless cats, and now they're all over the world. And in fact, this is something that we will see show up just randomly as a genetic defect in, you know, just random bred cats on a farm or anything, will suddenly a cat will show up that's born without a tail. And so it is a genetic mutation. And some of these kitties that are these Manx cats will have a shorter tail. Some will have a little, like just a rump. Some will have a stump. Some will have a little bit longer tail. So you can see various lengths of tails. And it's because the gene isn't always totally expressed. It has what's called variable expressivity. And so it's one of those things where you may see some cats with shorter or longer tails. The big issue, though, is that associated with this taillessness state, about 20% of the cats that are born with this particular gene develop something called the Manx syndrome, which is where they have serious spinal cord defects. It's not just being tailless, but it's having abnormally shaped vertebra. They can have spina bifida. They can become incontinent. They may be paralyzed. And obviously, these are cats that are not going to be able to survive very long. And so, you know, it's a interesting breed of cat, and that it's based on a genetic defect. And this is very different than something like the bobtail, which is a relatively new breed that just came into the country about the 60s. We started seeing them. These will actually have a shorter tail. They breed true, and their tail is flexible, which is very different than the Manx, which have a quite deformed tail. So it's just, if you want a Manx cat, you have to be prepared that it may come along with some other baggage. And if you're going to deal with a breeder, deal with a reputable breeder that has these cats assessed before they get into your home.
Okay, great advice. Let's go back to the phone. We've got Anne in Green Bay with a question. Hi, Anne.
Hello. I'm wondering how you keep the kittens from crawling up curtains.
Number one, trimming their toenails. And it may have to be done every few days. And so that would be something having your veterinarian help you with. But I'm a big believer, especially in young kittens that are really super active, is, you know, putting those soft paws on. They're the little soft nail caps that can go on, and they're on temporarily until they shed the shell or the husk of their nail, and that's going to buy you some time. But when we have cats that are climbing the curtains, remember what I said earlier, you know, you can always say no, but what's the yes? And if you don't want the cat climbing your curtains, get them a cat tree. Get them something that they can climb up on, because cats like to be in an elevated position and looking down on us, because that's their nature. So, you know, keeping the curtains maybe at this point opened, or take them down temporarily if that's possible, and providing your cat with the cat tree in that area so they get used to climbing that. And hopefully, as they get a little bit older, the curtain climbing will stop if they can redirect their energy towards something a little more productive, like working on a cat tree.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Anne. Karen emailed to say that her son's 9-week-old puppy was treated for parvo last week. She came home from the hospital on Saturday, and last night she had some diarrhea and vomiting. Is this normal? Is she, as she recovers?
Yeah. Okay. Parvovirus is one of these viruses that likes to affect rapidly growing cells. And the two areas in the dog's body where you've got rapidly growing cells are in the gut, which is why these dogs will get severe vomiting and diarrhea, because you lose the lining of your intestinal tract. That's why it's often fatal. This puppy is very lucky that it's alive. And it also likes to affect the bone marrow, because that's where we have rapidly growing cells as well. And so many of these dogs will end up with low white blood cell counts, and they can't fight off infections, and they become septic, and that's why they pass away. It's very unfortunate that the dog got exposed, and this is one of the reasons why we always recommend puppies get started with being vaccinated for parvovirus from 6 to 8 weeks of age, not being taken to areas where you don't know the health of other dogs, because this is a virus that can survive for up to a year in the environment. So you take this puppy that may be unvaccinated or not thoroughly vaccinated, and we have to vaccinate every 2 to 4 weeks out to about 16 weeks of age. I would not be taking this puppy to someplace like a pet store where no one's patrolling, but I would take the dog-to-dog training class, because every puppy there is in the same boat. They've got disinfectants available, cleanable surfaces, and they're not going to be allowing dogs in that haven't been started on the vaccination program, and hopefully they've all, you know, all the dogs are healthy in situations like that.
Okay, and let's go back to the phones with Rosemary in Cloverland. Hi, Rosemary.
Hi.
What's your question?
We have a little corgi, called, her name is Maya, and she has never had puppies, and my 'cause it's my son's dog, and we have never spayed her, neutered her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's still kind of like bleeding. And she's about, I want to say like about 8 years old.
Okay.
Is there such a thing as a menopause for female dogs?
Or yeah.
Well, do they just bleed all the time?
Well, dogs usually come into heat twice a year. And remember that bleeding is very different than what it is for humans. Dogs that have that vaginal, bloody vaginal discharge, it's when they are producing a lot of estrogen and they're becoming more fertile. It's not ending fertility. It's like you're leading up to, hey, I'm going to be ready to get pregnant. And I have seen dogs even in their teens still become pregnant because of a whoops. So they can continue to cycle well into their older age. And so you'll start to see infertility. They may, if you try to breed her at this point in her life, she may not produce that many puppies. It may be more difficult to get her pregnant, but she still may go through some of those hormonal cycles that they do twice a year. And so I would be recommending, if you're not planning on breeding her, getting her spayed now. It's not going to change the incidence of breast cancer. The damage has already been done hormonally for that, but it will stop her from developing a very serious condition that can happen when they are cycling, that's called pyometra, or a pus-filled uterus, and that can be a life-threatening situation. And doing it now while she's healthy, it would be much better than waiting until she's older and sick and has an infected uterus and is now at big anesthetic and surgical risk. So consider getting that done now.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Rosemary. Let's go to Christina in Glenwood City next. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I have two healthy barn cats. They're sisters. They are very talented mousers. And so I have three quick related questions. I'm wondering how often should they be wormed? What type of wormer should be used for barn cats? And can you recommend a good product that can be purchased over the counter or the website?
Okay. Probably the two or the three big parasites that we'd be concerned about in a barn cat would be tapeworms, like we talked about earlier. Roundworms would be another one that we get concerned about, as well as hookworms. And so those would be the ones that I would be wanting to make sure that we're providing treatment for. And so the things that you would be looking for would be a product that has a drug called praziquantel, which you can get over the counter by itself. You can also get a product over the counter by itself that is called pyrantel, and those are, you could use those together. There is no over-the-counter product that is going to be a one and done that you are not going to be able to get without a prescription. You'll have to get them through a veterinarian. And I have many people that have barn cats because the Center for Disease Control recommends that cats that are barn cats be dewormed quarterly, which means every 3 months, to keep tapeworms and other parasites under control, not only to keep the cat healthy, but to keep the humans that are living with the cat healthy as well. And using that product called Profender, which is a spot-on product, works very well at getting roundworms, hookworms, and tapeworms, and it's kind of one and done, and it's easy to use. So that's all we can, I really can't make any other recommendations of anything you're going to find over the counter, except if you start putting a couple of different products together.
Well, easy is a key to cats.
I know.
Yeah, no pills.
Yeah, and it does. That both of those things alone taste horrible, and that's why I love the Spot Hunt product, because it's just like, squirt, you're done, you know.
Yeah. Yes, easy for everyone. Okay, thank you, Christina. Good luck with those kitties. Let's go to Sim in Appleton. Hi, Sim.
Gosh. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so just last night I was feeding. I've got two cats. One of them is a female calico. She's about 9. And I had picked her up, and she was so excited about the food, she jumped out of my arms and didn't stick the landing quite well. So she must have landed on her face a little bit, and I noticed there was one of her teeth was left on the floor. It was her canine teeth.
Oh.
It was a horrible experience for everyone involved.
Wow.
Yeah.
But she didn't seem to be too fazed by it, and still till today, she she's not acting any differently. She's eating her hard food just the same, and she's, you know, napping and walking around like normal. And I'm wondering, what can I do / should I do?
Yeah, you know, cats are really good at hiding pain, and it's just normal animal behavior, because if they show I'm uncomfortable, I'm painful, they're going to become someone's lunch, okay? So that's kind of putting it graphically, but, you know, especially wild animals, but even our domestic animals are really good at hiding pain. This has to hurt. And when we see kitties that are still, even if they may eat still, because they don't use their canine teeth to be picking up food, they'll often use their tongue and swallow their hard food whole. They may crunch it a little bit with their molars and premolars in the back. The big concern that I have with a fractured canine tooth is what you see of the tooth is about a third of it. About two-thirds sits in the bone of the face, up in the face, and that is going to be sitting there and potentially could abscess, because now you've got an open path of the outside world into that pulp cavity, and now you can run into issues with a tooth root abscess, which can become very painful. I've seen cats that have actually had this happen, it's been ignored, and they've had enough bone loss that when we open the mouth, we can now see a clear path from the oral cavity into the nose, because we ended up what's called an oral nasal fistula, an open hole, and those can be really tough to deal with. So I think going into your vet, it's your kitty's 8 years old, you said, probably in need of a dental cleaning anyways, and get some x-rays done, see if the whole tooth has fallen out. If there's still a root left, that needs to be elevated and removed, and it needs to be surgically taken care of.
Oh, I hope that works out for you, Sim. We're talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She's a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Do you have a question about the health of your pet? We have some open lines, so give us a call, 800-642-1234. And Sandy, we had Colleen email us to say that her, I think, 14-year-old cat has developed an insatiable appetite. She meows constantly. Every 2 to 4 hours, she wants to eat, and the vet is suspicious of hyperthyroidism. She's lost weight since July as well. What do you think?
That would probably be my first diagnosis. Between that and diabetes, those are probably the two most common things that would cause a cat to be losing weight, meowing more, and wanting to eat more. And hyperthyroidism, an overactive thyroid gland or a goiter on the thyroid, is almost becoming an epidemic problem for our senior cat population. It's an easy enough thing to diagnose. We do what's called a resting T4, and it's a blood sample that goes usually to an outside lab. If your cat tests positive, there's a number of different treatments, medications that are applied topically, usually on the inside of the ear. I know it sounds weird, but they can't groom themselves there. Pills that are given orally, radioactive iodine, and even a low iodine diet that they can eat, and that can be very helpful as well.
Okay. All right, and let's go back to the phones. We've got Christine in Oconomowoc. Hi, Christine.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a approximately 4-month-old kitten who has cerebellar hypoplasia and is profoundly deaf. She's doing beautifully. However, she is terrified of being picked up off the ground.
Yeah.
And then she writhes to the point where she will fall out of your arms, fall off whatever you've picked her up on.
Well, two things come to mind. One is if she startled her when she's deaf, that could be very frightening for her. The other is the cerebellum, which can be damaged when they're very, very young, usually in utero, by the cat distemper or panleukopenia virus. When they lose contact with the surface that they're sitting on, they really get disoriented. And so it may be that she's going to be one of these cats that you just don't pick up, and that she's kind of on your lap or on the floor, but you're just not picking her up and carrying her around, because it can be very uncomfortable for them. And how good of you to adopt a special needs kitty.
Yeah, they adjust. They really do adjust.
I had one named Bob because he had a head bob with his cerebellar hyperplasia. Yeah.
Oh, cute. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Sandy. We've been talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She's a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and she'll be back with us on November 28th. Thanks to our executive producer, Michelle Johnson, on-air producer, Louisa DeVogel, Michael and to Dave Potras for technical direction. Join us tomorrow for our Wildlife Roundtable. We'll be talking about the deer hunt season, regulations, and changes to the DNR. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening.